Stephanie Land had big plans for her life as a writer. She's there now, but the plans got derailed by pregnancy. She found herself single, with a child, no job, and just about no money. The details of that time and the long, slow climb out of it are contained in Stephanie's book, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie Land focuses her writing on social and economic justice as a fellow through both the Center for Community Change and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, and more. Stephanie Land, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of Nickel and Dimed, wrote the foreword. She could return to a middle-class life. Did you have anything in that way of that sort of safety net available to you?
No, I had absolutely no safety net. My family couldn't even help me out, or friends tried to help me out by way of hiring me to clean their houses, but that was really about it. I had a very inexpensive, cheap car, and if that thing broke down, then we were out of luck. So, not much underneath me by way of support.
That's some first sentence in the book. My daughter learned to walk in a homeless shelter. Wow. What were the things that led up to that particular incident?
Well, her dad was pretty emotionally abusive, and so he kicked us out. And I went and stayed with my dad for a few weeks, and that didn't work at all. And so we ended up in a homeless shelter back in Port Townsend, Washington, where I had just ran from. And we were allowed to stay there for 90 days. And so I think the day after that 90-day was up was Mia's first birthday, like the day after her first birthday, I think. And that was right around when she was learning to walk.
Wow. So things obviously not quite as you would have planned years before. Your life had changed so much, and then so had you. I mean, you described this in the book. What did you see when you looked in the mirror?
Oh, I was incredibly skinny. I had to keep going back to Goodwill to get smaller jeans. I think I was like a size 6, which for me is really small. And I didn't eat much, obviously, but I also didn't get much sleep. And I think there was a constant buzz of what I now know as panic, or, you know, recovering from trauma. At the time, I just thought I was really stressed out.
You had wanted to be a writer, you report in the book, as long as you could remember. But what thought had you given to being a parent, if ever?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't really see it happening for me, I guess. I was pretty jaded by my late 20s. I just kind of thought that, you know, I wanted to do it the traditional way, I guess. You know, you meet someone and you get married and you decide to choose, you know, you like make this choice to have children and bring them into the world. And I didn't see any of that happening. So I was just kind of doing my own thing and then found out I was pregnant.
Talk about the relationship with Jamie, Mia's father. I assume some of these names are changed to guard people's identities. But the whole thing with Jamie, how did that come about?
Oh, we met in town on, you know, like a summer evening and started dating. And, well, I guess we were kind of dating. We were both, our goal was to move out of town. And so, for those few months before Mia was conceived, we were living together in this tiny little like camper trailer, because it was a good way to save up money because rent was really cheap. And then I got pregnant on the night of my birthday, actually, in September, and things drastically changed after that. For me, it was like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is a change in direction and this is what we're doing now. And for him, he was very resentful and angry that I went that path instead of to choose not to do that.
So he wanted you to have an abortion and you said, nope, not happening.
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but this is not like a vague plan you had for your future. You actually had firm plans about where you were going to be next and what you were going to be doing once you left Port Townsend, weren't you?
Yeah, I was filling out applications for college for the University of Montana. I was saving up money. You know, I was working all the time. And I had planned to move there, I don't know, like end of December or something before the next semester started.
So Port Townsend, Washington, is probably not the best place to be a broke single parent. Give us a sketch, if you would, Stephanie, of the economy there.
Actually, Port Townsend, Washington, was a pretty good place to need government assistance because the population is so low. They have resources. Like they had a grant there for a program called TBRA, which is tenant-based rental assistance. And that is kind of what you get on while you're waiting for Section 8 housing. And Section 8 is kind of like a permanent certificate within the state that you can use. And their wait list for Section 8 at that time was only like 6 months to a year long, which is kind of unheard of. Like other wait lists are like 10 years long. So Port Townsend was actually a good place for government resources, but not so good for finding a job.
Right. Okay. So the job itself, not a great thing, but at least you had access to some services that you could lay your hands on, maybe faster than you could have in a larger place. The book is called Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie Land lived it, wrote about it, and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join the conversation by phone and email when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're learning about one person's struggles to get through in life and get out of the lower class, which is Stephanie Land's story as she found herself broke, single, and a mother. She writes of what she had to do to get out of that situation in the book Made, as in housemaid, hard work, low pay, and a mother's will to survive. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Stephanie, give us a bit of backstory, back to your birth family and money and what your circumstances were growing up.
Well, my parents, they started out pretty young. They had me when they were 20, and my dad was out of work at the time, and my mom was like running a restaurant. And so my dad started working as an electrician and stayed in that job. I think he's still doing that. And so that kind of took a dive at times. But my mom was the first one to get a college degree in our family, and she worked as a social worker. But I grew up, you know, pretty lower end of middle class to begin, and then pretty securely in middle class by the time I was in high school. And but you know, there was no money really for college or anything like that. So I was kind of left to do that on my own. And, but yeah, nothing that would set me up for a life of, struggle, I guess.
All right. So you weren't in poverty, but you know, not a lot of spare money around, but not in poverty. So then how much of a crash course was it for you to get used to things like SNAP and TBRA and any of the other government assistance programs you had to turn to?
It was some weeks like a part-time job. I mean, there were classes that you had to go to like learn how to use it. There were a lot of appointments with caseworkers. I felt like I was constantly on the phone calling, you know, whatever number I could find, to find things like, housing and childcare, resources, because I was going through kind of a custody battle, resources for legal help, for like a home visit nurse or a therapist to kind of have a third party opinion on my mothering ability. And it was just, I started a notebook that was just full of all of these people that I was calling. It was mostly for housing that I was looking for.
Third party opinion on your mothering ability. What was that necessary for the custody?
Yeah, the custody. He was trying to show that I was a mentally unfit or whatever. He was trying to get custody of Mia.
You mentioned that Jamie didn't particularly want to be a father to Mia, but how quickly did that turn sour? I mean, it sounds like things got ugly pretty much right off the bat.
Yeah, I mean, he came around for a few months and then I think just kind of grew resentful again. And, you know, like I would say things like, I would like to start working again and I would like to get a job. And he would say things like, I don't want to give up my weekend babysitting. And we didn't really like each other all that much. I very much wanted to, and I wanted to make it work, but it was just a very toxic environment.
So we mentioned the first sentence in the book, Made, my daughter learned to walk in a homeless shelter. How long were you in that shelter?
It was a 90-day stay. Mm-hmm. And then we would, from there, we went to transitional housing, which was income-based housing through the same housing authority. And then we were there for a few months, I think.
So getting out of the shelter and into transitional housing is certainly a move up in the world. But how on edge were you at that point, just from life in general?
I was pretty jumpy. I felt very vulnerable, and I suddenly had this tiny little human to take care of, and just driving around and everything that I did, I was very aware of. Dangers around me, I guess, and just felt incredibly alone and pretty sad because of that. And I was tired and I was hungry and I was working as a landscaper, and it was pretty difficult for me. But I still tried to be as present and happy as possible for Mia.
Working as a landscaper on the Olympic Peninsula sounds like kind of spotty work.
Well, in the summertime, you know, it was a kind of a wealthy area, Port Townsend is. And so there were a lot of people with gardens that needed maintaining. I started working with a friend of mine's husband, and so we just kind of like go around with him and pick weeds, basically, and cut back blackberry bushes. There was endless amounts of that.
Stephanie Land, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. You mentioned that you were sort of lower middle class growing up, not in poverty, but not a lot of spare money. Growing up, though, had anything hardened in your mind about poverty or the people who fall into it? Did you have some preconceived notions about essentially about the situation you found yourself in?
I think we kind of all do in some way. Mine came from, you know, we grew up going to church, and every Christmas we would give to whatever charity the church was supporting, whether it was like delivering a meal or the little angels that they would hang on the tree. Sometimes at the mall too, like you see those where you buy presents for needy children. We always did things like that. And I think like even as a high schooler, like I went on mission trips and witnessed to people in the park. And so that was kind of my experience with poverty, I guess, was trying to get them to find Jesus.
Ah, so you get to help some other people in ways that you thought was appropriate to their circumstances, but didn't have to spend a lot of time in poverty, certainly yourself. So it sounds like your eyes got opened in many ways. I mean, for one thing, you mentioned how potential landlords view Section 8 clients, people who are coming in with vouchers, with the government assistance helping pay part of their rent. What kinds of things did you observe there?
Well, I mean, they generally think that a Section 8 family is going to trash the place and that they're not going to take care of it. And I think there's a lot of stigmas surrounding poverty that all fall back to not working and not caring and being neglectful and I guess overwhelmingly dirty and like broken down cars and all of these things that like we associate with low income housing or bad neighborhoods when really, you know, when I was in that situation, like it was extremely hard to come home and clean the whole entire house by myself after I had been cleaning all day.
And so did you make extra efforts to present yourself as well as you could to potential landlords or, you know, people you were going to ask for jobs, things like that?
Yeah, I tried. But as soon as I said I was a single mom, either for the employer, because that meant that they would have to worry about two people calling in sick instead of just one, because if my kid was sick, then I would be the only one who could take care of her. I also had to work during daycare hours, which is generally Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. And those are the prime shifts, the daytime shifts for a lot of the jobs that I had experience with, like coffee shops and restaurants and things like that. And I didn't have any professional experience at that time. So, and this was also like in the height of the recession. So a lot of people had been laid off and were now taking those entry-level, you know, administrative assistant type jobs. So for the first time in my life, I could not find work. And then with finding housing, I became very aware that finding a house or finding a place for, a mom and a kid was much different. Not only because of what her needs were and what my needs were, but, I think landlords kind of have a person in mind that they want to rent to. And I was often not that person.
Stephanie, I get the sense though, that aside from any economic relationships with people who either you're going to give money to because they were going to give you places to stay or get money from because they employed you, that I got the sense from reading the book that the lack of money only added to the lack of people in your life. It sounds like it was a very lonely time for you and Mia when she was really little.
It really was. And kind of detrimentally so. I mean, I tried as hard as I could to consider Mia as company, you know, or just another human being around that I could like at least get affection from or, but I really needed, companionship or support or even like a good friend. I worked alone, all of my college classes were online that I did at home after Mia went to bed. And I didn't have any money to go out. So those three things led to a pretty isolated existence for those years.
Stephanie Land is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She focuses her writing on social and economic justice. She's a fellow at both the Center for Community Change and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, and she focused on herself in the book Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. We'll talk about the cleaning houses thing in just a moment. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Talk about poverty and perhaps your own experiences with it and societal attitudes toward it in your phone call or email to the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So what led to you and Mia moving in with Travis, who had the horse farm with his family?
My dad had given me some birthday money. And so I took Mia and myself out for lunch. And then with the rest of it, I got a subscription to Match.com. For me, it was kind of like a social outlet, and I only saw it that way. I really didn't think that anyone would be actually interested in me or dating me. But I ended up meeting this guy who lived in a town that I really liked, and we clicked pretty well. And I don't know, like 4 or 5 months after we met, I decided to move in with him. And for me, that was a decision very much based on what I thought would be best for Mia. Like, I, you know, who doesn't want to grow up on a horse farm and in this like huge, beautiful property and area, and all of my family was in that area. And so I didn't really take the time to stop and think about whether or not this was a good environment for me. But for me, it was just, it was like, yes, like Mia needs to be surrounded by family. Like I thought maybe I could reconnect with some of my family. And it was kind of a sense of moving home, like, and getting out of Port Townsend, because at that time, I was having severe panic attacks, and really needed to get out of that town.
Panic attacks just because of the overall situation you were in?
Yeah, but the custody case by that time had gone on for almost a year, and I was still battling for child support and going back and forth about a parenting plan, and the exchanges with Jamie, Mia's dad, were highly stressful. He was not very nice. and it was just all really stressful. And I had been extremely stressed for a long time, and my body was just finally over it and just done. And I started having panic attacks where I was actually like crawling on the floor, like thinking that I was going to die because I couldn't catch a full breath.
Wow. What kind of first aid did you get for the situation?
I was in therapy at the local domestic violence, sexual assault services. And she kind of gave me the brown bag theory. Like if you breathe into a brown bag, it might help you. But at the time it was just kind of, trying to get through it. And I kept telling myself, nobody dies from a panic attack. And just tried to, I don't know. I just tried to get through it, I guess. I really had no idea what was really going on with my body and why it was happening. But I knew somehow that it wasn't permanent, and I just had to get through it.
But I can see certainly, you know, with that backdrop, it's like, okay, things are really not working for me in Port Townsend. So, you know, moving in with Travis and his family on the horse farm makes a bit more sense, certainly in that context. Talk about your first work as a maid, though, and how that came about and some of the frustrations of that first work.
Well, the first job that I got was like a friend of a friend who needed someone to help with her small business. And I guess the frustrating part of that was that I had no set schedule. I was paid a little bit more than I eventually was with the cleaning company. And I was paid for my travel time, which was pretty huge. But it just, I would get like texts the night before about whether or not I was working. There was nothing that I could really budget for. I was promised all this work, and then I was working very little. And so I continued to look for other jobs and ended up with another cleaning company, and tried to do them both at the same time. But the schedules are so variable that it was hard to keep two jobs at once.
You know, your own situation was certainly one of struggles, but it clearly didn't cut off your compassion. Talk about, if you would, Stephanie, what you noticed of the people whose houses you cleaned and some of the senses you got from what their lives were about.
Well, I really started to care about them, and that was very unexpected. I saw that a lot of them were aging and sick, and they were kind of all they had was each other, and they were taking care of each other. But then there were also people who had lost a spouse and were kind of left to take care of themselves. And then there were clients who just seemed to work all the time and were constantly sick. And, you know, I was in there maintaining spaces in their houses that they never used. And to me, that just seemed so sad that they would work so hard for these huge houses that they were paying me to maintain, but not able to enjoy themselves.
In fact, there was one place in particular you called Sad House. There was a Sad House and a Mad House. What was Sad House about?
Well, the Sad House was the widower, mm-hmm. Who his health was failing pretty dramatically during the time that I was there. He was actually next to the house that I called the porn house. And that was named for, I guess, obvious reasons. But both of those people, it was kind of like the different ways that your relationship can go. Like, you can have this wonderful life and do everything right and beautiful family and lose your spouse and kind of like die alone. And then there was this other couple next door who were very alone in their own house together. And it was just interesting to me to go from one house to the other on Wednesdays.
Oh, wow. That is a bit of a change there. Wow. We'll hear more about what Stephanie Land learned from cleaning other people's houses in the book Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us by phone and email when we return in a minute 15. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are hearing stories about what it is like to live in a situation of poverty. From Stephanie Land, who focuses her writing on social and economic justice. She's a fellow at both the Center for Community Change and the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Her first book is about her own struggles to get out of the lower class. The book is called Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. You can join the conversation as we talk about Stephanie's life as a young single mother and her work cleaning houses. 800-838-3760 for questions, comments, or your own stories about living and working your way out of poverty. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. I'm still struck by the differences between the houses you cleaned. We had the sad house where a man's wife had died and he was living alone and not very happily, but also places where both spouses were still alive, but they didn't have much to do with each other. So you certainly noticed them, Stephanie, but what did you observe about the awareness of the people who got their houses cleaned of you and the other people who cleaned them?
Oh, I don't think they even knew my name for the most part. But it was a cleaning service, and so they hired the service, and the service charged them an hourly rate and paid me less than half of that rate. And they had a very high turnover. It's a hard job, and it doesn't pay much. And so they never told people, "Hey, there's a new person coming." It was just a regular service to them. So I think if they told their clients, you know, just how many new people were coming to their house, it would make them a little bit uneasy, I'm guessing. So most people, if I didn't see them, they had no idea who I was or what even my name was.
How rigorous a background check? I mean, what sorts of things were done to make sure that you weren't going to lift things from people's houses while you're busy cleaning them?
It definitely had a background check, but, you know, I think I filled out one sheet of paper for one background check. But the cleaning service is also licensed and insured. And so if I broke anything or, I guess, stole anything, like, they would be able to, the insurance would cover it.
And you mentioned working for two different places, so that the first one was under the table payment and you got your mileage, but the second place was all on the up and up, so you got paid less, actually.
Yeah, I started out at minimum wage, which I think, or maybe it was a little bit over. It was $8.55 an hour. And then by the time I left 2 years later, I had gone up to $9.25 an hour.
So 2 years you spent doing this, and in 78 pages into the book, we learn of a physical condition that makes this work hard for you. What is that condition?
Oh, yeah. I have scoliosis and have had it since I was a kid. It got severely worse from getting pregnant with Mia. And I had actually like been to the emergency room a couple of times because my back had gone out and I couldn't move. And had right before I started working as a house cleaner, I had pinched some kind of nerve in my right arm. So I didn't have much feeling in my hand anymore. And I think some part of the work helped me because I stayed more active and moving, and I was, I don't know, it's better to move than it is to not move when you have scoliosis, and get some amount of exercise. But there were a lot of times in the job where I was kind of hunched over to mop floors, and that's like a really bad position for me, or lifted something that was way heavier than I thought it was, and my back would kind of spasm and go out. But during that time, like I remember I woke up at like 4 a.m. every morning because my back was so stiff and I couldn't get back to sleep. And there was like no amount of ibuprofen that would make all of that pain go away.
Wow. So you had a bunch of challenges just to be able to get through the day working the job. And in terms of the kinds of things you were seeing, I mean, I can only imagine what it must be like to clean other people's toilets and clean up other people's messes. But I mean, after a while, do you just sort of not really notice?
No. every toilet's pretty gross, even if it's clean. I mean, it's just, and the way that we had to clean it in the cleaning service, we just had Comet and a rag and a pair of dish gloves. We cleaned toilets out by hand. And it was nasty. And I never got over like the grossness of it. Like even cleaning my own toilet, I'm still just like, ugh, it's just gross.
So after you and Mia, your daughter, had moved in with Travis at the horse farm, who took care of Mia in those days of maid work?
I found a daycare center that was right around the corner that would take the child care grant. So she went to daycare.
All right. And then as the one full-time parent, what were some of the things you did to try to make Mia's life predictable, reliable, steady?
I was pretty obsessed with creating these little tiny routines. We still say this every night, like, good night, I love you, I'll see you in the morning. Like she kind of has to say those things to me every night. And then like bath time, you know, it was kind of the same songs, the same toys, the same way to dry her off. And I kind of wanted, I knew that I needed to be like the one reliable caregiver, like always show up when I said I was going to, always follow through with anything that I say I'm going to do. So all of these little tiny things, like I wanted her to be able to come home and kind of click into a very predictable life.
Which is great for Mia, but then what could you do to comfort yourself? Particularly in a situation at the horse farm where it sounds like you and Travis were not really on the same page about a relationship.
Yeah, there was very little. I think I started reaching out to friends through Facebook. That kind of became my social life. Either posting things or just messaging people. I found a way to connect with people on there. And also, I was so tired because I was working, cleaning houses, and then the house that we were living in with Travis, it was very dirty, and I spent probably an hour and a half a day just cleaning that, and then I was expected to make dinner, and then I had to do my online college courses. So I really didn't have that much time to be lonely, or it just wasn't, it didn't hit me as much, I guess, at that point.
And then Travis ultimately threw you out. How old was Mia by that time, and how did you get set up to move and find another place to go and be?
I think Mia was about to turn 3, or it was right around her birthday. And I reached out to those friends on Facebook, and a friend of mine encouraged me to set up like a donate button on my website. I had started a kind of a blog by then that my friends were reading and liking. And so I reached out for help. I created a wish list through Walmart that was like pots and pans and a few birthday presents for Mia. And And then Travis offered to match whatever people had donated. So between all of that, I was able to get into a studio apartment that was a little over 300 square feet. And the rent was only, I think, $550 a month. And I could barely afford that. So that's where we ended up going.
So, I don't want to give away the end of the book. Obviously, you've gotten your way out of that. You mentioned being a maid for about 2 years. Is it anything you would ever consider doing again under any circumstances, unless you had to, which really you had to here?
Yeah, I don't know. I do miss landscaping. I like that job. Like, I'll see landscapers in town and think like, man, that was a good job. I liked that job. House cleaning, probably not. It's just, there's so many things. Of course, if I had to, I would do anything. But house cleaning was, it's a pretty degrading position, especially the older you get, because a lot of your clients are the same age as you. And it just kind of creates a weird feeling, especially when you're self-employed and you're the one who has to go through and do all the walkthroughs and kind of create this relationship with a client, even though you're there to scrub their toilets. And a lot of people, like, especially when I worked as a house cleaner in Missoula, they were all self-employed clients that I found on my own. And I'm still friends with a few of them. And it's still just kind of, to me anyways, it's kind of weird. But it's a job that will always be there. I always kind of had a saying that as long as you're willing to get down on your knees and pick weeds or clean a toilet, you'll never have problems finding work.
Right, right. This sort of really came through for you for short stretches here, or for 2 years. But anyway, but so what kinds of recommendations would you give, Stephanie, as you consider the broader picture here for people who may think of people in poverty? It seems like we don't seem to get much out of that Dickens mode that if you're poor, it's your fault. And so what would you recommend for people to do something to lighten up a bit and remove some of the stigma from being in poverty?
Yeah, I think we're very caught up on this idea of the deserving poor. And like, we'll give toys to someone like Oliver Twist, but we won't give $100 to a single mom who needs a car repair, because we just simply don't trust that she's actually going to repair her car with that money. And that's a problem. Like, I think we kind of put a lot of blame on people in poverty. You know, we tell ourselves like, oh, well, they made all of these bad decisions in life to get them there, so therefore they brought it on themselves, so why should I help them anyways? And we kind of spread this narrative that has been around for decades, you know, the welfare queen, the sitting on the couch eating bonbons all day. We have this cassette tape playing in our head of what we think people in poverty are doing, and it's usually not working very much. And so I would just ask, you know, I think you can get started on just a community level. You can call your local domestic violence women's shelter and say, what do you need? And usually they need like shampoo and toilet paper and things that you wouldn't expect. And just kind of start there and start looking people in the eye, like learn the name of the person who cleans your office building, and learn how many jobs your Lyft driver is working. We are constantly surrounded by people who are very invisible, whose main job is to make our lives easier. And we're not even agreeing that they should get more money, that they should get a living wage. We're still fighting for 15, and we're fighting to remove work requirements from SNAP, and you know, fighting against this administration wanting to make it harder to access government resources. And I think if we go back to this basic human neighbor type of community level, we'll start to see just how many people actually need those benefits, and and what it would do if we just offered help, or if we started asking people, what do you need? And they usually have something very specific. And sometimes it can be as simple as a gas voucher or a gift card to Target because their kid's birthday is coming up, or very, very small things make a huge difference.
What was the small thing that made a big difference for you at some point? What's the fondest memory you may have about that when you were in your poorest days?
I actually got some like anonymous gift certificates or gift cards to Walmart. I found out who it was later, but people would send me gift cards every once in a while and just say, take Mia and get her whatever she wants. And that was huge for me. Like even up to not even like 4 years ago or something like that, like getting something like that around Christmas time that I could just spend on my kids, like especially for a stocking present, those things were the best.
All right, we learn a lot about your own circumstances in the book, but also a bit about societal attitudes toward poverty once again. The book is called Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive by Stephanie Land, who was supposed to join us a couple of weeks ago, got sick, and so glad to finally have you back, Stephanie.
Yeah, thanks for rescheduling. I really appreciate that.
All right, take care.